check it out.
Welcome to Top of the Class. Hear from education experts and get insights from high achievers to learn how you can do the same.
Get into those top schools.
Ready?
Proudly presented by Crimson Education, the world's leader in university admission support.
Hello and welcome to the Top of the Class podcast. I'm your host, Alex Cork, and today I chat with 15-year-old Dubai student Ariyanch. Ariyanch has just recently completed a three-month internship at one of the world's biggest banks, JP Morgan. We chat about how we got the internship, his views on GameStop and cryptocurrencies, and what students can do in high school to get a head start on a career in finance. Let's chat with Ariyanch. Hi, Ariyanch. Welcome to the Top of the Class podcast. It is awesome to have you on the show. Can you tell our listeners a little bit about yourself?
Good afternoon, Alex. Thanks for having me on. So I'm 15 years old and I am a year 10 student in Dubai. And basically, you know, for the last year or so, I've been building my entire life around finance and entrepreneurship. And basically just using, the intersection of these two worlds to explore myself a little more. And I've been working on a bunch of side projects that not only benefit me, but benefit those around me. And I think it's really awesome, you know, that I can create things that have a real world impact on people close to me.
Perfect. Well, just to give people a bit of context here, I actually connected with you on LinkedIn and I played a little bit of a game with my oldest brother, and it was guess the age of the person who is posting this content. And it was one of your posts regarding financial, Bitcoin, whatever it is. Like, you do some really impressive posts on LinkedIn, and my brother had a read of it and he was like, oh, geez, some pretty good analysis here. I'm going to guess this person's like late 20s, early 30s. I'm like, he's 15. And my brother was like, oh my God, that's crazy. And then, you know, setting up the interview, I said, oh, what's your email? And your email is that one finance nerd, right?
Yeah.
So, so when you say you're basing your life around finance and entrepreneurship, you really do mean it. Why finance and entrepreneurship? What really drew you to getting so involved in the world of finance?
It was practically a stroke of luck. So 2 years back, we had an email pop up in our school email inbox, and it was regarding this stock market challenge. And, at that time, I knew nothing about the stock market. I just knew it was reserved for rich people. So I decided to sign up, and we were given $100,000 of initial capital to invest as we pleased. Mm-hmm. And, I was like, oh my God, $100,000, that's a lot of money. So I decided to play around a little bit, investing in names I knew. This was all virtual, so it gave me a good flavor of the markets. And then I think it was really the adrenaline that you see whenever the stock tickers jump up or down, or the fact that you can do your own analysis on the market and that can actually affect how well you do. I think that's what really drew me to it. And then I realized, wait a minute, this finance thing seems kind of fun. So I contacted one of my family members, who's a fund manager at Fidelity, and he basically set me up with a bunch of books to read. So one thing really about me is that I love to learn, as in, be it a book, article, podcast, I love to take in information whenever I'm not doing something. So, he gave me a bunch of books to kind of keep me busy. And, once I read them, I kind of got really more intrigued into, not only stock market, but how there is a certain code to making money and there's a certain code to how the world works. And, it all revolves around this concept of money. And it's just like how you manage it and how the world manages it. And I think that really intrigues me towards, something to do with economics and finance as a career.
In terms of the books that you were recommended, what kind of books were they? And are there any titles that you recall and said like that one, really made a difference for me?
So, whenever you search up how to invest in the stock market, you keep getting hit by these three names, The Intelligent Investor, and there's a few others, but I think they're amazing reads. So I got recommended a bunch of books by this investor called Peter Lynch, and he actually managed, Fidelity Investments Magellan Fund, and he had one of the best track records as a fund manager. And I found that really interesting. So I was like, quite a lot to learn. So the two books that I feel of his have, helped me learn the most are One Up on Wall Street and Beating the Street. So big link to Wall Street there. However, I think it's very interesting because, once you look into the mindset of someone who has, endured all of these market cycles, big stock market dips, big stock market corrections, it's really interesting to see that, these people don't invest, like they're at a shopping spree. It's, you know, very careful. They do their analysis very well. And each of them has a very eccentric style of investing. And I think what's really cool is that, you know, you can imbibe these qualities into yourself. And then apart from that, I think, the internet's been amazingly helpful to me in terms of, actually inhaling this content. So there have been these awesome courses and podcasts that I've been listening to. That just helped me get a good flavor of how, you know, the finance world is moving.
Okay, so you're enjoying the motivation that you got from the game that you played. And just to be clear, that was like $100,000 pretend money, not real money.
Yes.
And for me, I played a similar game when I was in high school as well. But like I didn't go on with it because I think I got kind of bored looking at the numbers and it just seemed to go up and down. And I didn't really know too much about the work that you could put in to make a more informed choice. And it sounds like for you that that's the kind of switch that made you more interested in the investing side of things. Like once you start knowing that the more analysis you put in, the better your choices are going to be and the more ups you'll get than downs. Is that the kind of like game that you're playing, that you're kind of trying to, I guess, learn so much that you can outsmart the stock market?
I mean, well, technically, yes. Like, you know, the short story is yes. However, the long story is that, you know, it's like, you know, the house always wins kind of thing. So what I've been trying to do is trying to find companies and trying to find, you know, opportunities that I can quickly make use of as in, you know, trading on momentum. So, you know, let's say a company's coming out with brilliant earnings. What I do is I'd buy the stock and I'd just wait 2 weeks for the earnings kind of frenzy to pass. And then I'd sell the stock because brilliant earnings means that people are going to, you know, believe that the company's going to make more money going ahead. And that way the stock's going to go up. So it's just, you know, instances like these event-based investing, really.
Now, a lot of people would say you need to have money to make money. So if you don't mind me asking, where did you find the money originally to start investing in the stock market?
So actually, originally, it wasn't my own money. So I pulled together a bunch of friends and we decided to set up a signals group. And how a signals group works is that, you know, one person sitting there and he's the owner of the group. And what he does is he independently does his own stock analysis. And maybe, you know, he looks through a bunch of stock charts and comes up with a bunch of trade ideas. And these trade ideas are ones that he would use himself to make himself money. So what he does is, you know, he goes to the bunch of people in his signals group and he just gives them the trade idea for a small fee. And it's these small fees or these small commissions that slowly add up and end up, you know, profiting him as well.
Were you the signals guy?
Yes, with three, four of my friends. And then obviously I transitioned to working on a bigger project with a few other people.
So you're like the guy giving out the stock tips for a fee. You're like a consultant in a way, like a financial consultant. And so your clients were other students?
Other students, yes.
Yeah, so just within your school or from the wider Dubai area?
Oh, no, just within my school.
Okay, so like you've got a year level that's pretty keen on stock investing, or they're keen on it if they know someone else is going to do the work for them.
Precisely. I mean, that's the kind of thing. You're taking all of this stress on their shoulders. I mean, it went really well, you know. The good thing is they were all my friends. So, you know, there was a degree of understanding between us. But it was really interesting to see, you know, people are refreshing their stock screens every 2 seconds, reacting to little dips, little gains. And, you know, I found it pretty interesting just to see, as in not only from a psychological thing, but from a behavioral thing, as in, you know, how people respond to making money.
Yeah, yeah. Now, you don't have to give all your tricks right now, but what are some of the strategies that you like to use when you're investing in the stock market? I know a lot of people are more like the buy the solid stocks, hold them for, you know, 10 plus years and then see them appreciate over that length of time. But I guess when you're 15 years old, you don't really want to be thinking to 10 years ahead. So what are some of your strategies for that shorter term investments?
I'm really glad that you brought this point up, and I'm not going to get very technical with this, but
you can get a little technical. You can get a little technical. Don't be afraid to flex your knowledge a bit.
So there's these indicators. There's this indicator called the relative strength index, and it basically shows buying momentum versus selling momentum of a stock, and it condenses all the information into this really nice number. And you can use this number to do a lot of things. So there's basically two barriers, really. There's an eight. So, you know, the range is from 0 to 100. And once it gets to 20, that basically means there's been so much selling pressure on the stock that it is bound to go up. And once it gets to 80, there's so much buying pressure on it that it's about to go down. So obviously, it's just a nice indicator of how where the stocks can be moving in the short term. Then along with this, what I've done is I've been developing an algorithm. So how it works is, you know, you can call it high frequency trading or HFT. And how it works is the algorithm buys and sells stocks much, much faster than you or I could. So as in, you know, let's say it spots a certain price discrepancy from one market to another. And what it does is it buys a stock from one, sells it at another. And that's called arbitrage. And another thing that this robot does is, well, I mean, I had to develop it myself. And another thing it does is, you know, it gathers insider information. So as in information from people inside the company, and it basically sees their stock buying patterns. And, you know, there's a bunch of math formulas involved. But how it works is it condenses all of this activity. And once again, it puts it into a nice number. And that gives me like an insider sentiment or an insider confidence rating of a stock. And, you know, based on this insider confidence rating, I decide whether to buy or sell because, you know, it's the people inside the company that know best about what's happening with the company. Then there's this other technical kind of analysis tool that I've that a friend of mine and I developed called Brownian motion. And Brownian motion is actually the random movement of particles. So we just named it like that because we thought it'd be funny. But how it works is there's a bunch of moving averages. And moving averages are basically smoothed out averages of the way a stock price is looking. And we use these averages to find out things called support and resistance levels. And a support level is basically a price level at which the stock just won't go down. As in, you know, once it gets to that price, it is just too cheap for people not to buy. Yep. And the same way a resistance level is, you know, a price high enough that people are like, okay, this is too expensive. It is going to go down. So, you know, we use that kind of, we use these technicals to just get a good idea of where stock's going to be in the next week or so.
Now, a couple of questions. I love what you're doing. I think that's awesome. The algorithm to buy and sell quickly, the high frequency trading, is there not a brokerage cost on those kinds of things? I'm kind of like half asking for myself here, half asking for our listeners, of course. But, you know, like for people who have invested before, usually like if you invest with a bank or something like that, or like you invest through a bank, I should say, you pay like a fairly high brokerage cost on any trade. So that's like to even make the trade, they'll say, well, you got to pay us $30 just to make the trade, whatever it is. And is that something that comes up in HFT or how are you doing it?
So one thing that I really like to outline here is that for the last 2-3 years, we've seen brokerages like Robinhood on the rise, and they offer commission-free investing. As in, you know, zero commissions to buy or sell stocks. You can buy as much as you want. They won't charge you any fee. And I think, you know, how it works is, and these commission-free brokerages basically have the potential to wipe out all of the traditional brokerages that charge you pretty hefty fees on buying or selling stocks. Because if you think about it, you know, the average person isn't ready to pay a $30 commission on a $50 stock because that's just exorbitant. Yeah. And I think, you know, what's really interesting is how the rise of Robinhood and the actual kind of gamification of investing, let's call it that, has really led to the whole GameStop saga that we've seen happening over the past month. So when I use my HFT bot, I don't trade it on stocks. I trade foreign exchange. So foreign exchange is currencies. How many euros can I get for a dollar? How many Swiss francs can I get for a euro? That kind of thing.
Right. Okay. And is that performing well? Because I'm going to guess that that's not the first algorithm out there that is trying to predict foreign currency exchange rates and how to make, you know, that arbitrage, that difference on each trade. Like, I'm going to guess there's a lot of maths involved and there'd be some people developing like really good ones and some people developing not so good ones. How's yours doing?
Mine's doing pretty well. I mean, the purposes that mine serves are really short term. And, you know, obviously I don't have the infrastructure to make it a massive operation. And neither do I plan to, because the truth is that, you know, you've got these massive investment banks, massive trading firms, you know, that can execute at speeds you literally can't imagine. So there's this really nice book I read called Flash Boys. And basically a firm paid, I think it was excess of $50 million to lay a fiber optic cable straight through a mountain instead of taking the obvious route that was right around it. And, you know, it's this, so there's like a difference, you know, a 1.5 millisecond difference can literally be what changes between $10 million and $1 million. And I think, you know, that kind of speed an individual person like me just could never match up to.
Okay, but it's still a pretty cool thing that you're 15 years old and have developed an algorithm to trade foreign currencies. And where did you learn to create an algorithm like that? Is it something that you learned on YouTube through computer science courses? Like, how do you go about that?
So one beautiful thing about 2021 is that you can get any information you want for absolutely no cost via the internet. It's just that you got to know where to look. And what I did was, you know, I started with some really basic courses on Python. And Python is the language that I use for majority of my algorithm writing and execution. And basically, most of this was done via YouTube courses and via, you know, individual boot camps that were done for free. I didn't spend anything on learning how to make these robots. It's all a result of researching on the internet and reading as much as I can. Talking to a bunch of people in the industry is always helpful, I'd say. And LinkedIn is an amazing tool for this. So I'd say harness, like, you know, just a combination of three of those would be, you know, it would go a long way to fortifying your skills there.
Yeah. So Python, and then I guess knowing what you want the bot to do, right? Or what you want the algorithm to do, and then plugging it into your computer, right? So it can recognize the movements going up and down and making those trades. That's pretty awesome. Absolutely. I think that's pretty cool. And then you've got the brownie emotion, right? And, you know, with that, I'm going to guess that, you know, the random movements of particles, as you said, the whole GameStop thing, as you said, was like a pretty crazy thing for people in the game of stock markets would have been a bit surprised by that, because it pretty much threw out all the rule books. Can you sum up GameStop situation in an easy to understand way?
Okay, so let's, I'll start with this really nice monkey analogy. So, you know, let's say I'm a monkey and I have a banana, and the banana right now is priced at $10. And, you know, at the end of the day, but the banana is still a banana. However, I feel that the price, the value of the banana is going to go down. So what I do is, you know, I go to my good buddy Alex and I ask to borrow, you know, a banana that he has, and I immediately sell it on the market. And now I'm holding $10. So, you know, say 2 months pass and the actual value of that banana has decreased to $1. So what I do is I buy the banana back from those $10 that I got when I initially sold the banana, and I return the banana back to Alex. So Alex has what he gave me in the first place, and I have a nice profit margin of $9.
Right.
So this is how shorting a stock works, and how, you know, it's basically borrowing shares, immediately selling them, and buying them back later for cheap. And that's, you know, a key principle you need to understand when realizing, you know, what happened with GameStop. So GameStop is a physical, concrete video game retailer. And, you know, the COVID pandemic killed them, like quite literally killed them. So a lot of hedge funds thought it'd be a good idea to short the stock. That basically means they borrow shares that are really expensive right now, but are going to decline in value because the company's not going to be making any money.
Mm-hmm.
So they buy all these shares. They borrow all these shares and they immediately sell them. And now they're holding this money. And they want to buy it back later at a really cheap price. So they started shorting so many shares that at one point, they somehow exploited a bunch of loopholes, and they managed to borrow shares that did not exist, which is illegal. So a bunch of people on Reddit decided it would be a good idea to try to squeeze these investors. So let's get back to the banana analogy now. You know, say I'm holding this banana and suddenly the price goes up to $20. Now, suddenly that's a problem for me, because now I have to buy the banana back for much, much more than I paid for it. And that way it's going to benefit Alex, because he's holding something that is now worth double what it originally was. And if you'll recall, I have to buy the banana back, and it's like supply and demand. If I buy more, the price is going to go up more because producers feel that they can sell more. Yeah. And that's what happened with GameStop. So lots of people tried to buy the stock, and the stock price went up, and the hedge funds were like, oh no, I'm losing money. And they had to buy back more shares, and they kept on buying and they kept on buying. And the price slowly went from, you know, a low of like $2.50 to, I think its peak was $483. So, you know, it was really crazy.
What does that tell you about the future of trading and like the future of algorithms that are used to predict the stock market? Can people still use those kind of algorithms? Can people use kind of old school analysis to predict something like this? Or is this, I think it threw out the rule book in many ways, because a lot of people were saying that no one could have predicted this. It was purely like a user Reddit based kind of revolt of the people rising up against the hedge fund managers.
Absolutely. And I think you know, that's one really important thing to note here. It's that we saw a revolution, not only in the way that people invest, but in the way that, you know, how the market is rigged to benefit the wealthy people. As in, you know, these hedge fund guys, they somehow managed to borrow shares that didn't even exist. And, you know, that obviously infuriated a lot of people who are, you know, surviving off of stimulus checks kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, actually one interesting thing to note here is that the HFT bots, the frequency trading bots, ended up making a lot more money just because of the fact that the stock was so volatile. And since these guys trade very, very short term, as in, you know, the luxury they have is that they can put $1 million in a stock when it's at $1 and take it out when it's at $1.01. And have a $10,000 profit. But a normal investor just can't do that. A normal investor doesn't have the money. A normal investor doesn't have the time and doesn't have the speed to keep watching that trend. And, you know, I think what it's done is it's really shaken up the notion that the stock market is reserved for people, you know, with massive pools of money. And I think it's going to attract a lot more people. However, one thing that I'm really thinking about is that there are going to be people who, you know, like the hedge fund managers, they have a lot of money to invest, but an individual investor, he has to invest, say, his daughter's college fund. And if that goes upside, that could obviously not be very good for him. So it's just, you know, nuances like that that I think will end up obviously being bad for the little guy.
Yeah, I remember seeing a great quote actually that said, the fear of missing out, the FOMO of missing the boat on the next big, you know, GameStop, the next Bitcoin, the next Apple, or the next, you know, whatever. The FOMO around that is a greater driver for people to enter the stock market than the risk of losing money. Like the main risk is missing out, not losing money. Absolutely. Which is a weird way of thinking about it. But I think at the moment, there's probably more stories of the rocket ship to the moon type of stock, like exactly. GameStop and Bitcoin, and people making millions off the market, which is bringing all these people to the stock market and to cryptos and whatnot. Oh, I'm going to throw another one out there, actually. Dogecoin, which has been crazy.
Yes, absolutely.
Like Dogecoin has gone up like thousands and thousands of percent. And for people who follow Elon Musk on Twitter and have been asking themselves like, what the hell is he tweeting about when he keeps talking about Dogecoin and whatnot? He's talking about a crypto and, you know, people have made millions of dollars off this crypto. Not too many, but a couple of people have made millions of dollars off this crypto. And it was really just, it felt like a crypto based on a community. Like it didn't really serve any purpose as far as I can tell.
Exactly.
It was purely just like buy Dogecoin to be a part of this stupid meme type of thing. Like,
exactly.
What's that all about?
So, you know, the actual cryptocurrency was made because of a meme that came around. And it was about this Doge dog. I'm pretty sure you'd have seen the face.
The Shiba.
This picture. The Shiba Inu, yes.
Yep.
So someone made it. This, and, you know, anyone can virtually set up their own cryptocurrency. So someone was like, might as well do it. Dogecoin, it's a thing now. And, you know, this happened, I think, 7 years back. So this is when crypto was really fledgling. And, yes. You know, everything was really new. Someone was like, might as well make it as a joke. And, you know, that's how it had been ever since. But then GameStop happened and people were like, okay, I'm trying to find some more assets. I can YOLO my money on, and YOLO being you only live once. Mm-hmm. So, you know, take a lot of risk on it and just go all in. So someone was like, oh, Dogecoin. And Elon Musk, he's, you know, kind of, he tries to keep up with the trend. You know, he posts memes on his Twitter account. He's just really active that in that kind of sense. So what he decided to do was he decided to post a single tweet that said, much wow, M-U-C-H-W-O-W. And, you know, the Shiba Inu meme was that it speaks, you know, really broken English. And you know, Elon tweeted that and I was like, oh, no, Dogecoin. And on that day, the price went up, I think, 270%. And, you know, you've got people, you know, who've just put a $5,000 in this a while back thinking, might as well. It's just as a joke. And, you know, they come back and it's just ballooned. Their investment's ballooned.
You know what? I got on that as well. I was like, after GameStop, I realized that the stock market has so many who are, I guess, not willing to do the analysis, not willing to put in the work and just want to be on the next rocket ship to the moon. And when Elon Musk is championing this Dogecoin and then Snoop Dogg and like all these other celebrities and stuff getting on board as well, I thought, you know what? I didn't put in too much money, but I put in just enough to make it interesting. You know, it's one of those funny, it's a really funny time to be an investor. It definitely feels very much removed from the days of like, you know, Warren Buffett going to the store and trying things out and, you know, going through the analysis and looking at the costs and that kind of thing. It seems like a more fun way to invest. But in your view, is it a good strategy to be investing in fun things, or is long-term profits going to come from putting in the work?
I think what we saw right now, you know, I had a really good conversation with someone on LinkedIn the other day, and they said, you know, retail investors have made a mockery of the public markets. And I agree with that statement to an extent. This is the first thing we've ever seen of this style. Individual investors raiding the stock market. However, I still feel that it is not a good thing in the long run because, you know, these are people who are putting money that can change their lives into investments. And what I feel that's going to contribute to is, you know, if they lose that money, what now? Right. Yeah. And, you know, these people aren't very educational on the risks of what could happen if their investments, you know, go the other way. And they're in it for the joke. And what now? Quite literally. So I think, you know, people have had their fun, but I really think it's time, you know, for people to move on because the house always wins. There is always going to be someone who has more information than you, someone who is faster than you, someone who has more experience than you. And it's the same thing in the stock market. And what people don't realize is that it's these little advantages that add up. And I think, you know, it's all going to come tumbling down. You know, we've been like pumping this balloon to its very limit. So I have a feeling, you know, it's quite like a bubble right now. You know, you've got electric vehicle stocks going all the way. And, you know, we actually saw it a while back. Tech stocks had their worst day, I think, for the last 100 days. The U.S. Treasury bonds hiked their prices up by, you know, obviously a very high price. It was like 50 basis points in one day, and people got really scared, and tech stocks took it on the chin. And, you know, it's this kind of cascade, really, that I think can not only shake up the financial sector as is, but could shake up people's lives.
Yeah. Now, you've made entering the stock market or any kind of investing sound, I guess, a bit more realistic in the view that it is a bit riskier than a lot of people think, that it's not necessarily a joke and, you know, you got to take this kind of seriously. So for students who are listening and who perhaps have an interest in the stock market but don't have any money in it yet, what should they do or what questions should they be asking themselves or what reading should they be doing before they start putting money in the direction of the stock market and hoping for the best?
That's actually a really good question. And one thing I'd really like to outline is only invest as much as you are able to lose. So, you know, invest as much money as if you lost it the next day, as in, you know, if it evaporated, you'd be perfectly fine with it. It wouldn't have any impact on your life. And I think that's key to understanding how it's not good to get emotionally attached to the stuff you are investing in, because price fluctuations happen all the time. And it is definitely not going to help if you keep on refreshing the screen every 2 seconds and, you know, start crying or start celebrating over little dips in the price. So what I'd really like to think about, you know, everyone listening to think about is if you're investing in something, only invest in something you can understand. So Peter Lynch, actually, the first book I ever read, One Up on Wall Street, he said, you know, if you cannot explain the idea of the business to a five-year-old, don't invest in it. You have this company with, you know, a bunch of X's in their name, and it's like X Laboratories, and they produced wafer silicon chips for micro optical scanning.
Yes.
You know, really complicated stuff. But if you don't understand the product at its core, you shouldn't go near it. You know, which is why, like you said as well, you know, you'd hold on to a good stock for 10 years and wait for it to pay its dividends, wait for it to appreciate over that time. And I think that strategy, like it or not, that kind of strategy always wins. And it's like, you know, not to listen to your emotions too much, because there was this good post I saw on Wall Street Bets as well. The most important stonk you have is your brain, and don't let it fall apart due to a gambling addiction. And, you know, once you see all of this, you know, theoretical money pop up on the screen, once the stock prices go up, you know, you get happy. And once it goes down, you get sad. And I think if you give into your emotions too much, that can kind of not only lead to your investments just getting derailed, but your life as a whole.
That's some really good advice. And I always say to students, like, if you're going to be learning about anything, learn about investing, because it's a skill you should have for the rest of your life. You're not going to make your fortune. Well, the majority of people are not going to make their fortune through a job. They're going to make their fortune through investing, or like owning a business, potentially a property, whatever it might be. But you're never too young to start investing, which leads me to shift gears a little bit towards combining the two, investing and getting a job. You have an internship at JP Morgan, which will be a surprise for a lot of people who would have thought that it's probably, you know, more of like a university level thing to be getting an internship with, you know, one of the biggest banks in the world. Can you talk us through how a year 10, 15 year old landed a internship at JP Morgan?
So actually, you know, it was just by a stroke of pure chance. You know, I was scrolling through this kind of repository that I have of articles and links to internships, to job placements. And, you know, I came across the JP Morgan careers website, and I was like, you know, might as well click on it, explore what it is. So the good thing about JP Morgan's website is that it is laid out much, much better. And they have many more opportunities to offer than I'm pretty sure any of the other ones, any of the other investment banks or firms. And, you know, they've got really four classes of internship. And of these, I think two of them are available to high schoolers. And, you know, there's like an internship and a pre-internship. And so I decided to apply. And, you know, it was a fairly straightforward process. There was this really nice terminal. I filled in my stuff, handed in my resume. And, you know, that was it. Then I had I had to do this thing called a plyometrics test, which is really like an IQ test in the form of a small video game. Mm-hmm. So that was interesting, but I had to keep tapping my spacebar a lot. And, you know, that was really it. So I think what really stood out about my application as a whole was the fact that I showed like not only an interest in finance, but as in, you know, I had taken stuff to fuel that interest. As in, you know, I'd set up that little fund with my friends. I'd read out a little, you know, I'd worked on a little project about financial awareness, that kind of thing.
Right. And so what did it involve? What were you doing?
So what I've been basically doing for the majority of this is learning how to make financial models. And I think I'm very sure in investment banking, it's a very big thing, you know, because investment banking involves, you know, making deals happen. So, you know, when you get to a business, there's three financial statements you got to think about. There's an income statement, a balance sheet, and a cash flow forecast. And what I've been learning is how to, you know, make the very best of these models. And, you know, there's things called leveraged buyouts. And basically, it's a lot of financial modeling. And actually, over this, the internship, I learned how to use Excel without a mouse. So that was really one of the highlights of the entire thing. And so apart from that, I learned a lot more about the trading desks here. And so JP Morgan has an HFT segment. And, you know, what they've been doing is high frequency trading, like I said, trading mm-hmm. milliseconds. And, you know, I sat down, we were thinking about strategy with a bunch of the people there. And it was very interesting, you know, thinking about what stocks kind of big look for, what kind of features they capitalize on when they are trying to do high frequency trading.
Right. And you said one of the big highlights was learning how to use Excel without a mouse. I know that there's like a heap of shortcuts. And I know as well that like people might think, well, that's a pretty lame thing to learn from an internship at JP Morgan. But being really good at Excel and being really good at financial modeling is like a huge part of what a lot of financial analysts need to do. So how has your kind of skill set in that area gone from like fairly introductory to, you know, would you say intermediate, or where do you think you rank yourself against other financial analysts at this point?
So from what I've heard from talking to people in the industry, you know, you start out as an analyst role, like you said, and analysts basically get a lot of the grunt work passed down to them. And, you know, this involves quite a lot of number crunching. And I'd say, you know, my skills are really scrappy with Excel because I never used Excel for anything other than, you know, maybe creating a calendar, which is a very limited use case. And, you know, what I found is there is just so much stuff you can do with Excel. But now, I mean, I always have an Excel tab open for whenever I need to do a little bit of quick maths. And yeah, it's just amazing. And there's these really nice memes that's about how the whole world's banking system relies on Microsoft Excel. And, you know, just that's how prevalent its use case is. You know, you've got whole companies putting their balance sheets, putting their financial information onto this one piece of software. And the beautiful thing is the numbers tell a story of their own. Mm-hmm. And I'd say my skill set's gone from, you know, fairly rusty to pretty good. I mean, the keyboard's all I need.
Yeah, exactly, which is a real test of a good Excel user. And after doing the JP Morgan internship, what kind of doors do you feel that that's open for you in terms of like your notoriety among your peers as like that one financial nerd to the wider LinkedIn world? Do you feel like it's given you a leg up in that area because you can put JP Morgan on your LinkedIn profile and people know you for that?
I definitely say that does. You know, it's like the name just got a brand to it. And just, I mean, the experiences that I've, gone through, the work that I've done, it's really interesting to see how a big firm handles work. I mean, if I was a university and undergraduate student, if I did good, I'd probably get offered a full-time summer analyst role that, you know, I obviously would get paid for. But I'm not. I'm in year 10. when I talk to my friends as well, it's really interesting to hear about their opinions on a big bank like that. And you said it very well, you know, notoriety amongst my peers. So, I mean, the really, it's just amazing interacting with people in the industry, working alongside them, shadowing them, you know, just understanding how their thought process is, because these people who have gone to the very best of schools excel at the very best of what they do. And I think it's been an amazing learning experience. And I'd say in terms of opening up doors, I mean, I don't fully understand just how a company's got to tell its story through its numbers.
Of course, you know, you've been putting in all those numbers in Excel spreadsheets for the last couple of months. So it's good that you've had that opportunity. After the 3-month experience, are you more committed or less committed or the same to your future in finance?
So I think I am much, much more committed. I mean, you know, obviously the trading part of it is one thing, but I think what's essential as well is understanding these companies at their core. And I found this kind of experience to be like an eye-opener to things like that. I would definitely, you know, be 100% interested in a summer analyst or like, you know, a big bank. And I find that, you know, it's helped me a lot in understanding just how the world works.
Yeah, exactly. And in terms of where you want to go in university, like where do you see yourself studying? What do you see yourself studying? Like, is there much benefit to studying when you are already creating algorithms and doing all this kind of stuff in year 10?
So I really want to do this quantitative finance course at the Wharton University for my undergraduate. I've been looking at like, so my top choice schools all the Ivy Leagues, most of the Ivy Leagues. And, you know, that's where I really aspire to be. And just forming these kind of bonds, forming these relationships with people is really important. And then obviously I'm sure that the experience you get at, you know, obviously a top tier university, learning the things that you love doing would be much, much different from, you know, you try to self-teach yourself.
Yeah, absolutely. My general impression is that classes like economics is not necessarily the place to learn about the stock market. Am I right in saying that?
I absolutely agree with that. Economics is, I'd say, the language of how people work. It's like the good thing about economics is it combines, how people react to things that happen in the markets that they enter. You get onto the internet, the laptop that you've got, that's, you know, you've gone to a market, transacted for that. You know, you think about what to buy on Amazon. What impacts those decisions? You know, that's really more of a behavioral thing, which I think, you know, it's really poetic, really, how economics is this one language that encompasses all of it. And it's like, you know, a perfectly sound explanation for everything anyone does.
Yes. Well, that's what they try and do, I guess. And the rational economics type of thing, rational thinking, not always exactly the case when you have something like GameStop coming along, which is kind of flew in the face of all economic theory. But do you have any final advice for students who are perhaps aiming for a career in finance, banking, that kind of thing?
I'd say, you know, the biggest thing you got to remember is that your brain is, you know, the best asset you could ever possibly have. So I'd say invest more time on yourself, because that's going to ultimately lead to better investments for you. So, you know, the more books you read, the more courses you do, the more podcasts you listen to, the more people you talk to, just everything, you know, it's little steps. You might read a book and then just not think about it for the next week, but that book is going to change your outlook on something. And all of these little things, I'd say they add up and they go exponentially. So, you know, I try to do this as well. As in, I try to read a lot, be it an interesting article or like a book about a topic. I try to take knowledge in and try to make the best use of that knowledge. And apart from that, I'd say harness your social networks. And by social networks, I mean LinkedIn. So, a bunch of the projects I've been working on, I have met people. So actually, the entrepreneurship bug bit me, 8-9 months back mid lockdown. And the only way I found people to work on things like this with me was via LinkedIn. And if you network with people in the industry, it takes a bit of time to get used to. But I feel, that time that you could have spent on TikTok or Instagram, it's going to be much, much better served on platforms like LinkedIn, making meaningful impressions with the people that can matter most to your career.
And before you go as well, I wanted to know where you get your day-to-day information from, because I think a lot of people would think, okay, if I need to learn about the stock market, I'll read the Wall Street Journal, or I'll read, here in Australia, the Australian Financial Review or something like that. But of course, there is a lot of great online forums where you have like people who are super nerdy about this stuff, who are, telling you things that you'd probably never read in a newspaper. So what are your go-to resources for that day-to-day information about what's happening in the stock markets?
So if I want to know what's happening in the stock markets, as in, news-wise, I'd say the Financial Times. They offer a free subscription to secondary school students. So, it's amazing that ways. But for financial data, as in information on stocks, there's this amazing company called Atom Finance. And Atom Finance has been, serving my needs for the last year. So they offer like a month of their premium subscription for free, and it is amazing. They give you so much data that you just don't know what to do with all of it. And I'd say, information is really key to understanding what's happening, what moves are going on. So Financial Times, Atom Finance, and there's this one last one that's really underrated, but it's called KOYFIN, KOYFIN. And it's basically, like a proper stock trading terminal, except it's just really technical, and you don't need a mouse to use it. It's entirely keyboard driven, which is one thing I like, given the whole Excel of
Yeah. So KOYFIN, Financial Times, and Atom Finance, was it?
Absolutely.
Awesome. Well, I will recommend that for students listening to the podcast to save those in their favorites. And if students wanted to connect with you, what would be the best way to go about it? I'm going to guess LinkedIn is one of the options.
LinkedIn is the biggest option there is. I mean, anytime, just shoot me a connection request. I'll be more than happy to accept it. I love creating relationships with people via LinkedIn. My email, Alex very kindly noted that out at the start of the session, finance@gmail.com.
Perfect. Well, I'll put those in the show notes and hopefully some students reach out to you. Thank you so much for joining us, and I look forward to sharing the episode far and wide.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for having me on, Alexander.
Thanks for listening to Top of the Class. Subscribe for future episodes. For show notes and to plan your best future, head to crimsoneducation.org.